There's an exquisite book. It's called The Light of Asia. It was written by Sir Edwin Arnold, who also translated the Bhagavad Gita, one of the most loved and most beautiful translations that is mostly used in the reading that we have today. It was the best we had until Swami just recently re-expressed it all. But the story of the Light of Asia puts in beautiful poetic terms the life of Gautama, the Prince Gautama, who later became known as the Buddha, the founding of Buddhism. Buddhism nowadays, like many traditions that are centuries away from the founding inspiration, has become more dry and less joyful, perhaps, than it was at the time of the Buddha. Also, there's become an inclination to call Buddhism, it's almost atheistic. And because the Buddha's time and place was to emphasize to people the need for self-effort, and so he seldom talked directly about devotion to God, but it was understood in the Buddha's time that devotion to God was the foundation of what he was doing, not that it was irrelevant. And of course, time passes as it has in Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, and Buddhism, and lesser minds gradually clarify the teaching until you don't really have that much of an actual relationship to what started. So I say all that just as a prelude to say that I'm not really talking about modern day Buddhism, I'm really talking about the Buddha himself. And it's not that it's that different. But the story of Prince Gautama is a very moving one. He was born as the only son of a great, wealthy, and powerful king. And the ambition of all kings, the divine duty of all kings, is to increase the power of their kingdom and to have sons, so that they will have someone to pass to that increased power. And the great tragedy of the lives of kings is all about when they don't have sons, or when those sons don't turn out the way they want them to be. And this is the ongoing drama and delusion of human life. Well, when Prince Gautama was born, he was greatly anticipated. And there were many seers and astrologers and dream interpreters and everyone around making great pronouncements over the birth of this royal child. And the whole country was, you know, in awe that finally there was an heir, and on and on. But the predictions, serious predictions given to the father, the king, was that this son has greatness written all over his horoscope and all over his little body. All the signs of greatness are there. And that greatness will either be that he will become a great king following in your footsteps, or if he understands the nature of this world, he will renounce all of that and go off and become a great holy man, a great sadhu, a great renunciate. Now, the king had a very strong position in this. And the astrologer said that if this boy can be protected from knowing about the nature of life and the sorrows of life, then he will grow up to be a king, because there will be nothing to inspire him to leave the pleasures of the material world. So the story is told beautifully that his father arranged that the boy would always be protected from the sight of old age, disease, or death, which are, of course, the things that make this life less certain than we think it's going to be. When we're children, when we're young, when everything is in front of us, it all seems so promising. It's only the picture of our own aging parents, or the accidental death of those that we love, or illness that strikes us down at the height of our powers. These are the things that cause us to question what is really going on here. So the father built this exquisite pleasure garden and palace where he lived first as a child, and then when he grew up, and they got for him a beautiful bride, and they lived there, and every person in there was youthful and beautiful. And even they said, as Edwin Arnold writes in this beautiful story, in the evening when all were sleeping, the servants would come in and remove every flower whose leaves were beginning to wilt and replace them with all fresh flowers. So he grew up in this world thinking that everything was always perfect and beautiful. But as he became a little older, he began to wonder what lay outside the walls, because he became old enough to see that there were these walls to his garden, and he was never allowed to go out. And he kept asking his father and asking his friend, who was his chariot driver, what's beyond the walls? And finally the father saw he couldn't keep him imprisoned in the palace forever, so they decided that they would take him through the city. But of course, before he went out into the city, the word went out that everything ugly was to be removed, every old person was to be kept at home, every sick person was to be locked in their quarters, and that he would go through the city, which he did. He went going through the city, and there were young people and flowers, and everything was beautiful. It looked just like an extension of his garden. But one old palsied man, somehow or another, managed to either not hear or not regard the king's instructions. And he came staggering out in front of the prince's chariot. And the prince immediately was just overcome with compassion for this poor person, suffering person that he'd never seen the like of which before. And he ordered his chariot stopped, and he went down and he said, "What's wrong with you, sir? I am the prince of the king's son. It's within my power to do anything. I will fix it for you." And the old man said, "Who can stop the passage of time? Who can stop the decay of the physical body?" He said, "My fate is the fate of all men." And the prince went back to his chariot driver and he said, "I've seen enough. Take me home." And then he began to contemplate, and he prevailed upon his chariot driver to disguise him and take him out one night. And his chariot driver showed him aging people, dying people, ill people. And Gotama thought, "But if this is the end for all of us," he said, "all of this pleasure is for nothing, because sooner or later, all this pleasure of youth and sensuality and beauty and clinging to this, if no power known even to my father, who is this powerful king in this realm, can stop this," he said, "of what avail?" And he contemplated and he contemplated. And within himself, he knew, he felt, this is how the story is beautifully told, that there had to be an answer. And that instead of devoting his life to what he saw now was just the passing moment of youth and beauty, he would devote his life to finding a way to ease the real suffering of life, the threefold tragedy, as they call it, of old age, disease, and death. And he resolved that he would walk away from everything, all the beauty, all the wealth, all the power that was promised in his position. And then in Sir Edwin Arnold's story, they tell it so beautifully, because he had this beautiful wife, Yashoda, and she was pregnant with their first child, who was a son, or perhaps their child had already been born. So here he was, a father, and they have this he writes so sweetly about how he easily, Gotama easily said goodbye to everything. But in the bedchamber of his wife, he went in, and then he went out, and then he went back, and then he went out. Three times he visited her again, gazed upon her sleeping face and the face of his child. But he said, to their sleeping forms, he said, "Let it be known that if I am renouncing all of this to help the least known person, souls I have never even met, how much more I am doing it for you. How much more I am doing it for you who are so close to me." And then he walked out. And then his story goes on, and he does various ascetic things, and he explores the different ways of finding God that were available, the different philosophies, the different austerities, and he finally rejects them all. And then he sits down under the Bodhi tree, and he resolves that I will not move from this spot until the enduring, eternal nature of truth is revealed to me. Now, of course, he had done many things to bring himself to that point, so he sits in the lotus posture and is tempted by Satan in the form of Maya, who creates all of the temptations and desires of this world. And Buddha holds fast to his determination to see the truth behind them and to be tempted by nothing. Finally, he raps three times on the ground and declares, "Mara, I have conquered you." And all the delusion evaporates, and the infinite bliss is there. Then the Buddha's life goes on, and he becomes the Buddha. And they say the first sermon that the Buddha preached was just walking down the road. And his first disciples saw him from a distance, and they could feel something in him that they had never seen before. And they went to him and knelt at his feet and became his disciples. That's what they say is his first sermon, was just walking down the road. Now, the essence of Buddhism, as it is still taught today, is compassion. Each spiritual teacher comes, and they have a particular reason why they move through the world. Master was joy above all. Sometimes people speak of Master as a Prem avatar, but Swami speaks of him as an Ananda avatar. That's one of the reasons for the name Ananda. It means joy, as an incarnation of bliss. That was truly, really what Master's quality was. From joy I came, for joy I live. In sacred joy I melt again. In Swamiji's own autobiography, he begins by saying, joy has always been my first love, and I have longed to share that joy with others. It's such, so sweetly put. Swamiji describes in his own life, he says, my earliest memories are of an expansive joy that had nothing to do with anything that was going on around me. In fact, the world around me seemed to be but a dim reflection of that joy. Swamiji is talking virtually of his infancy. Joy is the characteristic of our path. That doesn't mean that other qualities don't come in. Of course they do. But it's partly because Master's mission was to stand in contrast to what has become, but was not the truth of Christ's mission. Christ's teaching has become defined as suffering. The more you suffer, the more you are really a true Christian. That's not what Jesus taught, but that's what Christianity had become. Master came as an antidote to that. Whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow were the coin of man's redemption. For us now, that payment has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy. Now, Buddhism began with compassion. That was what moved the Buddha. It's true that he saw in his own life old age, suffering, and death coming also, but it was compassion for those who had no out, no exit from this inevitable loss of everything that they held dear. And it was his profound desire that caused him, even as he said to his wife in her sleeping form, if I did this for those I have never met and will never meet, how much more I am doing this for you. Out of this deep desire to help. Now, this is the characteristic of true spirituality. And it's not a kind of grim duty. Oh, here we are, we have to help the poor, we have to go down to the soup kitchens, we have to do this, we have to do that. No harm in doing any of that if one feels inspired to do it. But Swamiji has written recently, he said, we have to understand that so often the way spiritual teachings have become, you look at somebody who's a good person, who goes to church regularly and is generous and helpful and upright and honorable, and you think of them as saintly. And Swamiji said, but you have to understand that the gap between merely being a noble person and being a true saint, he said, is the difference between a sapling and a full-grown tree. Because the reality of true God consciousness is not merely standing, this is how Swami put it, he said, because the good person is conscious of themselves as the source of the goodness. Do you see what I mean? He said, where the saint has transcended all sense of self and is conscious only that virtue is being expressed. But the virtue that they're expressing or the goodness that they're expressing is something passing through that has nothing at all to do with them. This is the way it was when someone complimented Paramhansa Yogananda, Master, on how humble you are. And Master's response was, how can there be humility when there is no consciousness of self? I mean, there can be a self that thinks of itself as small, but to have no consciousness of self, this is what the true state of a saint is. Now, the other side of that is that one recognizes that one is as much in everyone as one is in oneself. Now, this is the real reason why all spiritual teachings teach us to be generous and kind and so on like that. And even Jesus' statement, when they asked Jesus, what are the, of all the commandments, what are the greatest commandments? And Jesus answered, and Jesus was there in the context of being a representative of this huge body of knowledge and understanding and scriptural learning that was Judaism at the time. Jesus was standing in the middle of that. And they asked him, of all these instructions that God has given us through these centuries, beginning with Moses, what is the greatest? And Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. And that's a prayer that we repeat in our Festival of Light every day, every week, because we've picked up all these different strands. Thou shalt love, I resolve to love the Lord thy God. We say those words in essentially that way. And then he said, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And he said, and the second commandment is the same as the first. Now the way Master clarifies that is quite simply, thou shalt love thy neighbor because he is thyself. Because that which you call yourself is not separate on any level from any aspect of creation. And so what Jesus is saying, if you give yourself wholeheartedly to God without any reservation, then that just naturally encompasses this same commitment to the welfare of every being that lives as you have to your own welfare. It's really an astonishing expansion that is just so wonderful to contemplate. Now, this is why when we truly become deeply involved in the spiritual path, it ceases to... the laws of ego health and true spiritual realization begin to diverge at a certain point. Swamiji has written a little book called Sadhu Beware, which is a remarkable manual for the spiritual path. It becomes embarrassing because every time Swami writes a book, one seeks for new superlatives to describe how this one is the central one. You know, the Gita commentary that he just came out with, that was absolutely, this is the central one, which replaced, of course, yogic material success through yogic principles, which was the central one until there was the Gita, because it's a wheel. You can pick it up from anywhere. I mean, you pick anything up from the center and everything else follows. Just depends on where you stand. When I mean to say it's circular, it's not a line. Anywhere you stand, you can reach the whole circle. Anywhere you stand, you can follow a spoke into the center. But this book, Sadhu Beware, is particularly interesting. And if you haven't read it, I really encourage you to get a copy and begin to study it. It's a bit shocking because what it says is, essentially, it's always your fault. Don't even bother to think about it, right? Don't defend yourself. Don't justify yourself. Don't rationalize it. Don't think about standing up for yourself. You're not here to defend your ego. You're just here to overcome it. Because anything that just makes it stronger like this, ultimately you're just building fences you're going to have to tear down later. Because our goal is self-realization. And I started to say, if your goal is self-realization, everybody's goal is self-realization. Because to the extent that we are not self-realized, to that extent we suffer. Now, that relationship is not always crystal clear to us. Sometimes we think we're suffering because of what he did to me. We don't realize that we're suffering because there's still a me for him to do it to. Do you see? And we can work as hard as we want, just like Prince Gotama's father worked. That he was the most powerful monarch and he had limitless wealth, and he would make a perfect life for his son so his son would never question. He would just follow that life because there would be no reason to question. But of course, it was folly. But the reason that story is told again and again in the way it's told is because it's the story of all of us. Prince Gotama is our little desire to be good. We're going to be good. We might even be noble. We'll be generous. We'll be kind. We'll be all those things. But we'll still be me. You know, I'll still get to hold on to my ego self. My pleasant sense of what a good person I am. You know, like that. But sooner or later, As long as there is a me, that me will be vulnerable. That me is based upon the soul identified with the body. Sooner or later, things happen to the body. And they don't have to happen to you for you to feel acutely, you know, the futility of it all. Because once we begin to advance even a little bit, the ego breaks down enough that suffering in any part of the world is our own suffering. I mean, it's agonizing, the terrible consequence of the growing reality of communication and one worldness is now we know not only the suffering in our own neighborhood, but we get vivid pictures of the suffering all over the planet. And it's so intense, it just makes one feel like Gautama felt, which is, how can we stand this? How can we go on in a normal way without doing something to help? And I've spoken several times in the last few weeks, and many of you who come regularly have heard me, just talking about the confusion for the devotee of how to relate to suffering in the world. You know, how to relate to trying to fix things and make things better without going into it at great length here. It's a very poignant aspect of the spiritual path that's resolved in a very simple way. We give our lives to help. Greater can no love be than this. From a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death. That's for the salvation of others. In the Festival of Light every week, that's how we describe. That's what the masters do. They're free. They're beyond it all. But they remember. They remember what it was like to suffer. And they remember what it was like to become free of suffering. And that compassion brings them back again and again. No karma of their own. They have no reason to be here. They only come to help. And the path that the masters walk is the path that we walk. The Festival of Light, right after that phrase. Here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey. Because when the ego begins to dissolve, far from making you indifferent to others, suddenly there's the capacity to really know what others are feeling, and no sacrifice is too great. I mean, this is the state of the Buddha, and this, to its credit, is the image that the Buddhists have held above all, because that aspect has stayed with them. You become a bodhisattva. Rather than seek the bliss for yourself, you seek it for the sake of others, which is a true connection to the inspiration of their founder. We seek it for the sake of others. I remember one of my friends said so sweetly, he said, if I didn't know that my spiritual advancement, my eventual liberation, would help others, he said, it wouldn't be worth it to me to put out the effort. It's sort of a sweet, egoic, non-egoic statement, isn't it? And you have that story of Master, and he talks about, he says, in the poem, God's Boatman, he said, again and again, I will return, a trillion times if necessary, on bleeding feet, he describes, as long as one stray brother is left behind. It's really literally impossible to imagine. But if you think of it like this, if you yourself were in a state of agony, you wouldn't be able to stand it. You would have to do something to relieve your suffering, wouldn't you? If your consciousness was as much in everyone else as it is in yourself, you wouldn't be able to stand it. You would have to do something to relieve the agony. Isn't that extraordinary to contemplate? I've shared with you before the story of being with Swamiji at Disneyland. And a group of us were there, and we were just looking out at the crowd, and this enormous, this deep spiritual bhav came over Swamiji. And he just looked out at all those people. And he said to us, he said, imagine, he said, not only loving these people, all these people, but being every one of them. He said, that's the consciousness of the master. That there is no difference. Swamiji tells of walking with Master toward the end of his life, and Master was leaning on Swami's arm, and he stumbled, Master stumbled. And then he turned to Swami and he said, I'm in so many bodies, I forget which one I'm supposed to keep going. Now, that's the state of a master, but that's our state too. And how quickly or how slowly, how much we suffer, or how joyfully we move toward that, really entirely and only depends to the extent to which we follow what Swamiji is telling us in Sadhu Beware. I'm not here to defend my ego. I'm here to get out of it. Many times, Swami's seemingly strange behavior, sometimes it's very strange. He can be very passive in certain circumstances, strangely so. As he puts it, he said, if there's nothing at stake but his own convenience or his own personal reputation or his own embarrassment or anything like that, he'll just say, he says simply, I'm not here to defend my ego. I'm here to get out of it. If principle is at stake, in the same way, it's not about himself. It's merely that truth going through us. This is the life of a devotee. This is the life of one who is truly resolved to live not for self, but for the divine self, for the joy that there is in that freedom that is our true nature.